What happens when you're caught between a rock and a hard place? Maybe we should ask the dinosaurs. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, and I'm coming to you, as always, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at the University of Western Ontario, London, Canada. The history of this planet is littered with evidence of events that have drastically changed the conditions for life on a global scale. One of the most well-known examples of this is the Chicxulub structure in the Gulf of Mexico, a 150-kilometer diameter, 20-kilometer deep depression in the Yucatan Peninsula, considered to be responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs. This week, we talked to one of the most prominent voices in the discovery and classification of Chicxulub, Dr. David Kring, to discuss his career and research into the effect of impact craters on planetary geology and what he thinks it will take for humanity to successfully push out into the solar system. So without any further delay, let's have a listen. Okay, Dr. Kring, first of all, I'd like to say it's a pleasure to speak to you. It's great that you're here and taking the time to talk to us. We're very grateful. Not current research, but something that you're working on heavily at the moment is the origin of the Chicxulub crater and the discovery of that. So we'll talk about that a bit later. But I always like to start by asking about the background of the people I'm talking to and how you got to this situation. So what are the kind of steps that led you up to where your career has led you to right now?
Well, I have to say that the most inspirational point was when I was a young boy, I saw two astronauts step onto the lunar surface for the very first time. And that's the type of event, or actually the event, that inspired many people in my generation. And it was just really overwhelming. And I have to say that it's one of the things that I feel we have not provided to young people like you have here on the campus. We need another inspirational moment like that for today's generation. After having seen that, I knew that I wanted to go into some type of planetary sciences. The planetary sciences, however, as a field, did not exist. You could study geology or you could study astrophysics. I chose to do both since planetary science at that time did not exist. I studied at Indiana University. I then went to Harvard University, and I've been analyzing lunar samples and many other solar system samples for 35 years.
We find a lot when we talk to people that these inspirational moments are really important. Like, I really feel that we need another inspirational moment. Just as a quick aside, do you feel that the going to Mars or going back to the moon, do you feel that this is something that's close by, that we're making the progress needed to do that?
I hope so. I'm spending probably half my time every week working on getting human explorers out of low Earth orbit into deeper space. And while Mars is the long-term goal, the moon absolutely has to be done first. And one of the reasons for that is the people who know how to do that, who have experience sending astronauts to the moon and landing them safely on the surface and returning to the Earth, have now retired, or worse, they've passed away. Mm-hmm. And so frankly, we need to redevelop that workforce. We need to redevelop that capability. And so I'm very anxious to do that. We did just early this week see in the United States a new proposed budget for NASA, and there is part of that budget process a lunar exploration campaign that will send robotic precursors and eventually humans back to the surface. And I think if we can do that, and we can do that with our international partners, Canada, the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, I think that we will have one inspirational moment after another. Mm-hmm. I think it will be wonderful. From a science point of view, technological development point of view, from just the expansion of the human presence into the solar system. I think it will be magnificent.
Do you think that we need to make many technical steps to be able to achieve this, or do you think that there's only a couple of technical hurdles we have to get over?
We basically know how to do this. I don't want to say there's no technological developments. We have new metals, we have new computer systems, and all of those things have to be adjusted for this type of mission concept. But there's nothing overwhelmingly difficult. The biggest problem that we have to get out of low Earth orbit and get deeper into space is one of desire. People really need to want to go, and we need to be given a green light from civil authorities to do that. If we're told to go to the moon, scientists and the engineers involved will make it happen quickly, safely, efficiently, productively. It'll be wonderful. Mm. But we need to be given the green light.
That's good to hear, certainly. From my sensibilities, because I really feel personally that we should already be doing this. Like, this should be something that, like, I expected by the time I was this age that this would be kind of a regular thing.
Yes, and it's interesting you say something about time scales. It is something that we know how to do, and we can do in a relatively short amount of time. I mean, obviously Apollo was done in a decade. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we could do that. That was successful in part because a large amount of money was thrown at the problem. But we can do this for not as nearly as much money today. We just need the desire, mm-hmm. okay? But that desire can sometimes be ephemeral. And so I know in my own country, in the United States, we had a program called Constellation that was to deliver crew to the lunar surface. And at the time I became involved, we were actually supposed to deliver 2 rovers, 4 crew, 4 launch to the lunar surface in 2016. This is 2018. Yeah. And I have to say, the world would be completely different if humans were on the lunar surface again. Mm-hmm. And we would just look at the solar system differently, but more importantly, we would look at ourselves on the world, the Earth, differently. Mm-hmm. It's a powerful paradigm shift if we actually get humans back on the moon.
Mm-hmm. You're giving a talk here on the Chicxulub crater and your research in regards to that. So for our listeners, maybe you can just briefly go over the significance of that crater, and then maybe describe a little bit about what you found out about it.
Yeah, since we've been talking about the moon, though, let me start with the moon. If you look at this moon, you can go in your backyard and look up in the sky and see it. You are going to see that it is cratered. Mm-hmm. You'll see all of these circular features on the lunar surface, and every one of those are impact craters. Mm-hmm. Impact cratering is the dominant geologic process affecting planets, including the Earth. Now, the Earth is a dynamic planet, and we have other geologic processes, competing geologic processes like plate tectonics, erosion, and those tend to erase the impact cratering record. But I have to say, impact cratering has, over geologic time, been very important here on our own planet. One of the most important impact events is this Chicxulub impact event that you described. This is the impact event that occurred nearly 66 million years ago that we have linked to the extinction of dinosaurs and most life on Earth that existed at that time. Roughly 75% of the species that existed in the seas and on land all were vanquished at the same moment in geologic history. And it seems like this impact event, Chicxulub, which is an impact event that occurred in what is today Mexico, so change the environment of the world that animals just weren't, and plants for that matter, weren't able to survive.
Mm-hmm. So, like, how did that come about, that change? So when the impact happened. First of all, what do we have any indication as to what kind of object it was?
We still debate whether it was an asteroid or a comet, and I have to say we don't have a definitive answer, but I would say the evidence leans strongly to an asteroid. Mm-hmm. Okay, we actually do have a tiny fragment of this object that survived, landed in the Pacific Ocean, mm-hmm. and was recovered by scientific drilling. But it's a type of asteroid that is similar in many ways to comets, but it appears to be an asteroid. And this object is roughly 10, maybe 15 kilometers in diameter. It hit the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and it immediately burrowed into the Earth's crust to a depth roughly 10 to 15 kilometers, where the kinetic energy of this object, this collision, was released. And that energy was mind-boggling large. Mm-hmm. It was on the order of 100 million metric tons of TNT.
Wow.
So, just remarkable. It vaporized part of the Earth's crust, it melted part of the Earth's crust, and it disrupted and shattered even a larger region of the Earth's crust. And it threw a lot of the debris up into the atmosphere. The devastation around the impact site was immense. Nothing survived in the vicinity of the impact point. So throughout the Gulf of Mexico region.
So we're talking about the entire region of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes. Immediately, life was exterminated. But this impact event was so large, it carried a lot of vaporized material up into the atmosphere. In fact, a vaporized plume punched through the atmosphere out into space. And some of this material actually went halfway to the moon before it started to turn around and re-accrete to the top of Earth's atmosphere. Mm. And that is really the material that led to the extinction, because it affected conditions around the entire globe. We're talking about a period of initially high temperatures, followed by a period of slightly lower temperatures. We had a variety of acid rain. Probably one of the most dramatic effects was simply dust in the atmosphere and choked off sunlight. Mm-hmm. So photosynthesis came to a halt. And photosynthesis is at the base of the food chains in the oceans and as well as on land. And so there was a cascading effect that, you know, went right through complete ecosystems. We believe there were impact-generated fires. Mm-hmm. Those fires would have been most intense in North America, specifically the United States portion of North America and Mexico. We can actually see a change in the vegetation response to this impact event with distance. And so what you actually see in Canada, in British Columbia, for example, is different than what you see in the southern United States. So we actually do see some regional differences.
How do you know all this stuff? You've painted for the listeners a real, like, quite an in-depth story of, like, how these effects all coalesce to produce this outcome. So exactly how are you getting this information together? I assume it's from a multitude of sources, and you're piecing together the story this way.
Yes. Well, this is basically a geologic story. So it starts with geology. Our ability to discover the impact site started with geology. In fact, even before we found the crater, the idea that an impact event caused this mass extinction event is geologically. Some geologists found the chemical fingerprints of this impact event at exactly the horizon in the stratigraphic record where dinosaurs and life was extinguished. Mm-hmm. It took us about a decade to find the impact site, and that again is a geological story. The environmental consequences are inferred in part by calculations, mm-hmm. Computer calculations, but they are confirmed in part by what you can actually see in the geologic record. So, for example, I mentioned that there were fires. Mm-hmm. We find soot on top of the ejecta blanket where it's been distributed. I mentioned acid rain. We find actually chemical leaching of the impact ejecta blanket. I didn't mention it, but we also think that the chemical composition of the atmosphere was severely perturbed by the impact event, and that can be inferred in part by the rocks that were actually hit and are seen in the walls of the crater. We see, for example, limestone, which when vaporized by the impact event would have produced greenhouse warming CO2. We also find anhydrite, which is a calcium sulfate mineral, which when you vaporize it would have produced sulfuric acid rain. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this is geological, but it's supplemented with some geochemistry and the physics of a large collision.
But even, say, when you're talking about the effects of vegetation and so on and so forth, I imagine that for somebody who has some kind of background for that kind of information as well, from the fossil record of, like, you know, plants and stuff, that information is also useful. Am I correct in that?
Absolutely. So there are paleobotanists, and some of the best ones are actually here in Canada, who've done some wonderful work out in Alberta and Saskatchewan, where they look at the impact ejector blanket, and they look at the vegetation below it, and they look at the vegetation after it, and it is completely different. It's like night and day. Mm. So below the impact ejector blanket, you can see a complex forest ecosystem, because you see the pollen from the understory, you see the pollen and the fossils from the forest that had provided a canopy, and then after the impact event, you'll see things initially like limited to just ferns or just algae. Mm-hmm. And it will take a very long time after the impact ejecta is deposited in the geologic record before you start to see this complex woodland forest canopy ecosystems returning. So yes, the paleobotanists have done some wonderful work in that area.
So, okay, thank you very much for the interview. It's been really, really eye-opening, and I've certainly very enjoyed talking to you. I have one last question, which is that if anybody's listening to what you've just said and they're interested in this sort of area and they would like to get involved, do you have any, like, tips or any advice for anybody listening who's really interested in getting into this kind of area?
Well, I'll give you a couple of different answers to that. If you are in Canada, there are some wonderful museums, and I would go to the museums. And you have the Royal Tyrrell Museum, wonderful place. Anyway, you have some wonderful museums and parks with some of these KT boundary sections available to you.
Yeah.
If you want to go online, you can certainly go to the Lunar and Planetary Institute. We have 5 or 6 pages specifically for students and educators that kind of introduce you to the field. And in fact, some elements that some teachers actually might want to actually utilize in their classes. And so that's, I guess, the other place I would start.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, David. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. And wish you all the best in the future, and hopefully I'll have you back on the show soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
So, what did you guys think about that interview?
I love dinosaur killer craters, so... Every time I go to schools, that's, you know, kids will love talking about dinosaur killer crater. So... Yeah, I enjoyed it.
What about you, Dana? Did you find what did you find particularly interesting about David Kring's experience and so on?
I took away his talk about how he got into this field just through, like, the Apollo missions, and how he was talking about how we don't really have anything going on right now that is inspiring the new generation to get into this. And I kind of would dispute that a little bit. I think the stuff that SpaceX is doing is certainly gathering a lot of attention from people that would normally not be interested in anything space-related right now. So I feel like that is, in at least a small amount,
contributing.
Yeah.
But there is, like, a definite lack, not lack, but there's definite difference in scale, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the when we were growing up, these were, like, very large things that, like, involved a lot of people, and, you know, it was something that was always being talked about, you know, it was always that it was something that was always on the forefront of your mind, whereas now it's almost, it's not quite like that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I think that's probably one of the reasons for that is the privatization of space, because you now have private companies that are, you know, wanting to go to Moon and Mars and, you know, explore, rather than it being a government thing, which is where every person is paying the tax that's going towards what is happening, right? So it's two distinct things. So you have private company where people were investing their own money in you know, going and explore, and then the other one is where people are investing their money, their tax dollars to. So when it's privatization, it's that company's achievement. The other ways is the country's achievement, or, you know, whichever countries are involved. Like, so everyone is involved when it's government missions.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, everyone is interested in everyone. Yeah, like, it's not that the people are not interested in knowing, hey, what SpaceX did. But it's different in terms of how much involvement there would be of people wanting to have a say on everything that's going on and see it succeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is, of course, absolutely true. I feel like it was more of a kind of thing that if you talk to people about it, they were sort of more immediately engaged or intrigued by the whole thing. And obviously in the 60s, with the Apollo missions and so on and so forth, you know, nobody knew anything about. It was a complete mystery to most people. So the idea of going out there and finding more information about it was something that was on just on everybody's mind. Whereas now it's kind of not. There's not the necessary intrigue with it, maybe.
Right.
Which is what I'm saying.
Yeah, like the Apollo missions. That was the space race. There was the whole urgency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
getting there before.
I forgot about that as well. So, yeah, of course. Yeah, there was the whole political.
Yeah.
Side of
now there's really
exist.
No urgency right now.
Yeah, exactly right.
I want to add one thing to the previous point.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that it's also a lot of information overload.
Yes.
For everyone who's. Thanks to Google.
Right, yeah.
And, like, all the search engines on the internet. Back in the day, you get your information from people and or the newscast that comes at 6 or 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's information everywhere. So people are very selective in what they read and, listen to. And that makes it more difficult for people to have broad, you know.
Yeah, no, that's actually a very, very good point, you know. That's a very good point.
So that's why, you know, there might be kids who are not exposed to these kinds of things because, hey, they might be learning about cancer or they might be learning about biology, chemistry. Like, there's so many things that they are trying to learn that you don't always get all aspects of.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, of course, there being so much more information, you can decide, you know, what you look at when, you know.
It's also all live. Right? You're not waiting to hear from, you know, that's one of the reasons why people, if they're thinking about going to Mars, they don't think about the time lag and things like that.
Yeah.
Because people are used to having information on the tip of their hands, able to communicate right away. They're not, generally this new generation is not from the era where they had to wait for the internet to connect.
Yeah, exactly.
Being able to...
I remember that. I remember 256K modems and them making this really weird sound.
Yes.
It was a really weird sound they used to make when it was connecting.
Anyway, so for the Chicxulub, I love learning about the Chicxulub just because it's one of the most important things in the history of Earth,
mm-hmm.
right? It basically wiped out the most, I guess, predator, the biggest predator.
Well, several species.
Several. But I guess dinosaurs were one of the big ones that we wouldn't be here if it were. They weren't eradicated, right?
Yeah.
So it intrigues me how that happened and what the entire process was.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by Parshti Patel and John Kissy and featured an interview by host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts John Kissy, Parshti Patel, and Dana Beaton. Our editors were Dana Beaton, Parshti Patel, and John Kissy, and I'm John Kissy. Our theme music was Heliosheath by Sean Kemp. You can continue the conversation, find out more about Western Worlds, and listen to past episodes by visiting our website at www.cpsx.uwo.ca /westernworlds or checking out iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. On behalf of the entire Western Worlds team, thank you for spending this time with us. We hope you'll return in future for the next episode of Western Worlds. Thank you.